Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 6th of June. In his article yesterday on the National Post coming out of Toronto, Canada, our guest Jonathan Kay writes, 40 years ago, yesterday it was, a fleet of 200 Israeli airplanes took off and flew west at low altitude toward Egypt's airfields. The commander told his pilots, "Fly, soar at the enemy, destroy him, and scatter him throughout the desert so that Israel may live." Within 3 hours, almost 300 of Egypt's 420 combat aircraft were blown up on the ground. Runways, radar stations, air defenses, all systematically wiped out. Egyptian pilots died as they ate breakfast. The commander reported that the Egyptian Air Force had ceased to exist. Without air cover, Egypt's army, the most powerful in the Arab world, was defenseless against the coming onslaught. Our guest Jonathan Kay goes on to write that Israel's anniversary celebration of the Six-Day War is bittersweet, and he will explain that. He is managing editor for Comment of the National Post newspaper, which I said comes out of Toronto, Canada. He's also a regular contributor to Commentary Magazine and the New York Post. He has written for Harper's, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The International Herald Tribune, LA Times, Weekly Standards, and many other publications. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Jonathan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's an anniversary that's well worth marking, isn't it, because of what's happened since. It really, as so many people have said, laid a groundwork for a situation that has been so difficult for so many years.
Yes, particularly in the West Bank and Gaza, and in Jerusalem, which, many people would argue is the source of the Israeli Arab dispute.
Yeah, we're going to get you on another phone line because your level is so low here. So if you, Mimi will call you right back just so that we can hear you clearly for the important conversation. Jonathan Kay is with us for this hour, and I'm sure that many of you have thoughts about the Six-Day War and also about the long-term effects of this war and the kind of war that is being fought now, which is quite different than what was happening 40 years ago. Second hour of our program today, we're going to be looking at CAFE standards, which has been going to be debated in the Senate. Presidential candidates have talked about CAFE standard. It's been a long time since we've had an increase in CAFE standards. The question is why? What would they need to be in order to lessen our dependence on foreign oil? And we'll be looking at that issue at the second hour of our program today. And Jonathan is with us again. Hi, Jonathan. I just couldn't hear you very well. So if you want to repeat what you were saying, that'd be great.
Sure. No, I was
there
just,
you go.
Yeah, sorry about that. In terms of the last 40 years, the most salient aspect is the West Bank and Gaza, and Jerusalem in particular, because it was thanks to the Six-Day War that those territories became came under Israeli possession.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you say, it was a bittersweet victory for them because of those areas coming under their occupation and what's happened as a result of that.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that this was not part of any preconceived plan. Originally, when the Six-Day War started, Israel wanted it to be strictly an Israeli-Egyptian conflict, and they didn't expect that Jordan would come into the battle. And it was only as a result of happenstance that Jordan did participate in the war, and as a result of that, Jordan, which then controlled the West Bank and Jerusalem, lost those to Israel. And at the time, Israel wasn't even sure what to do with these territories. There was thought of giving them back in return for peace, and it was thought that the West Bank could become sort of a federated part of Israel. No one could have predicted what would happen over the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm. How did Jordan come into this in a happenstance fashion?
Well, there was a lot of rhetorical unity between the various Arab states. Jordan and Syria and Egypt, they were all, at least publicly, prodding each other to go to war against Israel. Because at the time, one of the great doctrines was this idea of pan-Arabism, the idea that the Arabs were one people. Egypt and Syria at one point had even formally agreed to kind of unite their countries in a sort of a loose kind of way. In the way that militant Islam is an ascendant doctrine now, pan-Arabism was very much an ascendant doctrine then.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least rhetorically, there was a lot of words in the air that, well, you know, an attack on one Arab country is an attack on all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jordan felt a lot of pressure to join the war once Israel was sending its tanks through the Sinai. On the other hand, Jordan knew that its military was no match for Israel's. So what Jordan did is it started bombarding parts of Israel from the West Bank. And as a result of that, Israel responded with an invasion of the West Bank and Jerusalem. Had Jordan stayed out of the war, arguably, Jerusalem to this day would still be in Arab hands.
Oh, interesting. You write in the piece that there was not very very good fighting on the part of Egypt in a lot of Arab nations, with the exception, perhaps, of Jordan. Why was that? First, well, there are two parts to the question. Why didn't anybody really fight? And why was Jordan fighting?
Once Jordan got involved in the war, their troops actually were probably the most competent, in part because their officer corps descended from a more British tradition. It was a more Western-style force with Western-style command and control. Still no match for the Israelis, but at least a semblance of a modern fighting force. The problem with the Egyptian and Syrian armies wasn't that the soldiers were no good, although most of them were conscripts and they didn't have very good weapons and such. It was a more basic problem than that. The problem was that the officer corps was mostly composed of political hacks, people who had been promoted through the ranks because they were someone's brother-in-law, or because they came from the right tribe, or because they were politically connected with the president. And many of them had no experience, and when fighting broke out, many of them simply abandoned their troops, and the troops were kind of left to fend for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it's a very sad story. Thousands and thousands of Arab troops died for no good reason and because their commanders essentially abandoned them.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of impact did that have on the soldiers to have their leaders abandon them?
Well, first of all, the morale was horrible. I wrote in my column, in one instance, the Israelis, when they invaded the Golan, they actually found rank-and-file Syrian soldiers chained to their machine guns because the officers had fled back to Damascus. And in fact, many of the leaders back in Damascus had actually fled Damascus because they thought an Israeli invasion was coming, and they brought with them the nation's gold supply, actually. They looted the nation's gold supply, and they fled Damascus. I mean, it's a completely cowardly retreat by the leaders. And, the ones who paid the price were the rank-and-file Arab soldiers.
Mm-hmm. You talk about in it being in the Arab world where the historical impact of the Six-Day War remains most keenly felt, the Israeli victory so enormous, the humiliation, a key word of neighbors, so complete that it discredited single-handedly Arab nationalism and also Egyptian President Nasser.
That's right. Nasser at the time, this is going back to the 60s, I guess it's hard to find an equivalent to him today, but he was kind of like Iran's president and Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez, sort of all rolled into one. He was seen as this great champion of third world pride and anti-colonialism, and he was an extremely imposing figure and charismatic, although by 1967 he was probably a less impressive specimen. And so he personified all this. And for him to be humiliated was very much for his movement to be humiliated. And that, as I was talking before about this pan-Arabist utopian ideology, the idea that the Arab people would collectively rise up and they'd smash the lingering British presence in the Middle East and they'd smash Israel and they'd confront the United States. And that whole ideology was discredited.
Hmm.
And as I argued in my article, once the dust settled from that, the late 70s and then in the 80s, it was militant Islam which really filled the void.
Mm-hmm. And so now the kind of fighting that's taking place is quite different, with fewer troops and without the air power that Egypt and other nations had. Israel is fighting now is even more formidable with less.
Well, it's a very different kind of combat, right? Because the military doctrines in the Arab world in the 60s were very much based on the state, the Arab state, and organized armies, tanks, air forces, missile systems, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was obvious that the Arab world couldn't destroy Israel through those conventional means, and Islam, militant Islam, became the dominant doctrine, you now see a more grassroots kind of warfare. It's warfare that not only does it have no connection to states, groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and so forth, they actually work better when they are not formally attached to states, because a state can be attacked. You can bomb the capital. You can mine the ports. You can. It's very easy to attack a country. But in the case of Hezbollah, for instance, in 2006, it was very much to their advantage that they were at arm's length with the Lebanese state.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It's a form of combat that doesn't take place with tanks or with aircraft, because those can be destroyed instantly by any powerful state like Israel. It's by men hiding in towns and
right.
Roadside explosives and, well, exactly what the United States, what the American army is confronting in Iraq right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did Israel deal initially with these impoverished Palestinian towns you write about in your article, the refugee camps that had formerly been the problem of Egypt and Jordan? Now all of a sudden they're Israel's problem. Was there planning for this eventuality?
No. Well, no real planning, because, until the last minute, there was a question about whether Israel would even go into Gaza, and where the fighting proved very bloody during the 67 war. And as I said before, the original plan called for absolutely no invasion of the West Bank. So once they actually found themselves in these territories, they really didn't have any clear idea what to do. And then a few years later, the settler movement started, and Israel started building settlements in these territories, and that led to a whole other kind of problem. But as I said, there was probably a very naive attitude among Israeli leaders that they thought that, well, maybe the Palestinians could be convinced to join a kind of federated Israeli structure. There were probably many Israeli leaders who were extremely happy to see many Palestinians flee east into Jordan or flee to other Arab countries, because they wanted the country as a whole to be as Jewish as possible. But there was no coherent plan about mm-hmm. how to deal with this problem.
Mm-hmm. Was there, some people have been mentioning this week, the possibility of a peace that could have taken place? There was an interest in each other. There was something that could have been done that would have established perhaps a lasting peace. Do you think that may be the case?
Well, I think there were many people, including many Israelis, who embraced the concept of land for peace. And, that is eventually what happened with Egypt, right? Egypt got the Sinai back. And Egypt and Israel signed a peace deal. Despite the fact that relations between the two countries are still very frosty, there is at least nominally a peace, and there hasn't been a war between the two countries since 1973. The problem is that for countries like Syria, the conflict with Israel simply has too much of a propaganda advantage for them.
Hmm.
And the plight of the Palestinians has too much of a propaganda advantage. And Syria has been blaming its problems, all its domestic problems, for decades on the fact that Israel occupies the Golan Heights. And it's not clear to me that Syria, for instance, even wants to solve the problem of the Golan Heights, because Israel makes such a convenient scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that territorial dispute festers, it's sort of like the Shaba Farms area, which is on the border with Lebanon and Syria and Israel, and that is Hezbollah's pretext for attacking Israel. From a propaganda point of view, it is extremely useful for militant Arab terrorist groups and for enemies of Israel, like Syria, to have a war situation, or at least nominally a war situation, so that they can deflect domestic frustrations and keep blaming Zionism for all people's problems.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about what prompted the Six-Day War. What were the threats Israel was experiencing? Why was the action taken?
Well, the action, basically, it was a case of Nasser overplaying his hand. He had convinced himself that Egypt could win a military confrontation with Israel, and it was on Egypt's initiative that the United Nations peacekeepers that had been in the Sinai from 1956 onwards, that they were expelled. And this is, I think, the key fact, that it was, although it was Israel that commenced the hostilities in June 1967, it was Egypt that expelled the peacekeepers from the Sinai the previous month. And I think everyone interpreted that as a prelude to war. Egypt had also cut off Israeli shipping in the Red Sea, which was a second de facto act of war.
Mm-hmm.
So Israel fired the first shot in June 1967, but it was really the culmination of preliminary steps toward war that Egypt had taken in the weeks leading up to that.
Jonathan Kay is our guest this hour, managing editor for Comment of the National Post newspaper, printed in Toronto, Canada. He wrote a piece yesterday, Tuesday, June 5th. Article is 6 days that changed the Arab world forever, which appeared in the National Post. And we're talking about the Six-Day War this hour and the ramifications for problems in trying to establish peace in this part of the world ever since. The importance of that in having so many problems erupt of the Six-Day War. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Lines are open for you right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, CAFE standards. Should Congress be mandating 35 miles per gallon or 40 miles per gallon or more? We'll talk about why this country has not taken the mandate issue very seriously for a long period of time, what automakers in Detroit think about mandates, what presidential candidates think about mandates and the president. So that's coming up the second hour of our program. 800-486-8655, the Six-Day War, 6 days that changed the Arab world forever. Jonathan Kay is our guest, and we start our calls with Derek from Round Lake. Hi, Derek.
Good morning. I got an interesting question, actually, to your listeners and also to your major speaker here on the program. When 1967 war has happened, this also has represented a certain awakening of the Muslim fundamentalism, which actually was originally participated in Israel's support of the Hamas movement, which was supposed to be some type of a alternative, more controllable alternative to the PLO. And it also seems to me that since the Egyptian and Syrian government regimes were defeated, which were highly socialist, this has also represented some type of movement to the left by Ba'ath regimes, often Syria and Iraq, actually where the king was deposed back in 1969 and Ba'athists took the power over there. Is the 1967 war representing some type of divergence of the Arab thought as far as the looking at their political future and political inclinations that would mark their own developments for the next 40 years? Or is it just contained just in the specific area of Egypt, Israel, Lebanon, Syria?
Jonathan.
The caller raises an interesting point, certainly about Hamas. It is true that in the 1980s, Israel took a fairly benign view toward Hamas because at that time, Israel saw the idea of Islam as an identity for Palestinians as welcome, in the sense that it offered a break from the ideology of the PLO, which was largely secular, Marxist, and really had its roots in the 1950s and 1960s, the socialist revolutionary movement. And Islam was, at that point in history at least, was seen as a more benign force. And I think your caller is right that 1967 and the period after it really was a fork in the road for the Arab world, because, you know, people forget this, but in the post-war period, Arab politics was very much dominated by the USSR, by revolutionary socialism. Nasser himself was a Soviet ally. The PLO itself was full of Marxists, and it was a very secular movement. And this is fairly recent. We're only talking about 40 years ago. And now, of course, all that secularism is seen as completely the opposite of modern Arab movements. And a lot of this, not only 1967 war played a role in it, but what probably really played an even bigger role in that was the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, because that directly put Islamic Mujahideen including Osama bin Laden, against Soviet forces in this pitched battle that went on for the entire decade. And that was probably the major breaking point. And following that war, you saw the Muslim world largely reject secular socialist movements, and like Iran in 1979, really put their faith in an explicitly religious self-conception.
Thanks very much for your call, Derek. Kelly from Sheboygan is next. Hi, Kelly.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on, and I'm enjoying your program. My question for your guest is we were looking at the 1967 war and the events leading up to it, and it's interesting to note that Washington told Israel basically in the days and hours leading up to the war that they were on their own and that there would be no help forthcoming from the Americans. And I'm curious as to your guest's thoughts as to the repercussions that Israel and Washington's relations suffered thereafter. And also to get the guest's comments on the issue concerning these were conquered territories. These were territories that were taken in the course of a war that was clearly, if anyone thinks that this was a Israeli-initiated war, they're just not looking at what was going up until that war. It was clear they were going to be attacked. Why should the Israelis feel compelled to turn over territories that were clearly taken in a context of war back over to the Arabs? We've heard for years the Arabs complaining about the Israel being in the occupied territories, but no one ever talks about why they were there. So I'm very happy to see that the 67 war has been brought up back into the course of conversation again.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take your comments.
All right. Start, if you would, with the United States' response to this. Did we say you're on your own?
The American diplomatic response was extremely complicated because on the one hand, the Americans had an emotional, even by that time in history, had a strong emotional attachment to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting. In the opening days of the war, the White House at that point in history, the White House typically measured public opinion largely on the basis of the mail they got. And Michael Oren mentions this in his book about the Six-Day War, that the ratio of letters in support of Israel, the ratio of those to those that were against Israel was something like 98% supported Israel. So it was clear that the American electorate really did support Israel in this conflict. However, the United States didn't want the war to become a confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Mm.
The Soviet Union was making a lot of extremely aggressive statements about the war, including some suggested that they would come in militarily on the Arab side. So there was a possibility that this would become another Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans were very wary about that. And that is what largely guided their hand in terms of, yes, they supported Israel, but they didn't want Israel to go too far. They also were very mindful of the optics of it. And they didn't want Israel to fire the first shot. And when Israel did fire the first shot, mm-hmm. even though it was, as your caller said, as a result of Arab provocation, that was seen as something that that put the Americans off because they didn't want to be seen as on the side of the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
The diplomatic dance that took place in the United Nations, Soviet Union, the United States is highly complicated. It evolved over the 6 days, but the United States, it was guided largely by fear of a larger war on one hand and emotional support of Israel on the other hand.
Mm-hmm. Was it clear that Israel was going to be attacked?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a Egyptian plan afoot to head east to occupy the Israeli Negev, the desert in the southern part of the country, and link up with Jordan in the east. And it was a fairly unrealistic military plan, but it was the Egyptians' plan. And had Israel not attacked, Egypt may well have invaded in the next few months.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Marshall from Stoughton. Hi, Marshall.
Given your knowledge of the history, do you think Arabs will always try to destroy and remove the state of Israel? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Marshall.
The very foundation of Arab nationalism in the early part of the 20th century is largely based on the creation of Israel. It's really the only thing that unites Arabs. prior to the creation of Israel, it was there was really nothing. There was no such thing as Pan-Arabism because there was no cause that united Arabs. The creation of Israel and the success of Israel is an ongoing humiliation for Arabs because Israel is a wealthy society, it's a militarily powerful society, it's a democratic society. It is everything the Arab world is not. And as a result of this, it acts as an ongoing reminder to many Arabs in the Middle East about how backward their society is. The constructive response to that would be to build pluralistic, democratic societies in their own country. But unfortunately, the more popular response has simply been to try to destroy the Jewish presence, which acts as a reminder to Arab backwardness.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as that emotional reflex exists, yes, there will be endless hostility.
You do talk about, and it is extraordinary, what happened in 6 days, one of the most astonishing military triumphs in human history. A country that hadn't even existed 20 years previous would capture 42,000 square miles, expanding to 350% of its original landmass. That's quite something, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, it's... as I wrote in the article, it would not have been possible if you did not have the military pairing of a highly motivated force on one side, which is the Israelis. The Israelis can only lose one war, and that will be it. It's a tiny country.
Mm-hmm.
All it has to do is lose one war, and sorry, every war has existential meaning for Israel. At least that was the feeling in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
So highly motivated, extremely high morale, very well-educated, a brilliant military leadership in all respects, fighting against countries that had very low morale and many units of which sort of ran away when the first shot was fired. If you look at the gains the Israeli military made in the Sinai, it's almost like they couldn't have gone faster had they faced no military opposition. In many cases, they took as much land as they could get, pretty much as fast as their tanks could travel. And that was also true in the Golan in the last day of the war, where the Israeli army basically handed out guns to cooks and to truck drivers and said, look, just take as much territory as you can. When the UN finally stops this war, we want to have an Israeli soldier sitting on every hilltop. We don't care if it's a cook or a sanitation worker or a truck driver. You know, all the enemy has run away. So it's an astonishing victory, but it's also an astonishing testament to how powerful the force of morale is in war when one side is motivated and the other side isn't.
Right, right. David is next from Eau Claire. Hi, David.
Hi, great topic. I don't know if you had mentioned this at the beginning of the show, but I saw the Six-Day War documentary on public TV yesterday, and just amazing that I feel it's so important to have learned at least the basics of that conflict and how the implications continue. But my questions, one question was just with the UN and the Sinai, why did they pull out so quickly just from being asked? And then another question was the process of clearing out Palestinian housing around the old city and the Wailing Wall. I had no idea actually about that condition at first, that, you know, the geography was as it was, and there was a process of clearing out. And then my third question, briefly, is how is there any shift in the balance of power that was implied by the recent Israeli incursion into Lebanon from just last year or so?
Jonathan.
Well, to start, at the beginning, many of the UN peacekeepers were actually heartbroken to be leaving the Sinai. They thought they'd been sold out by the UN Security Council. They thought they had an important mission to do, and they were actually extremely upset that the Secretary General of the United Nations had acceded to Egyptians' demands to leave. Many people claim that the UN could have dug in its heels and kept its troops there, and the peacekeepers who were actually keeping the peace wanted to stay there and didn't want to leave, and it was a highly controversial decision at the time. In terms of the Palestinian presence in Jerusalem, I didn't understand the question. What was the question?
Oh, I was just wondering. I hadn't realized that there was such a Palestinian. Just my ignorance of the history. I didn't know that there was so many settlements so close to or within the old city up to the Wailing Wall. And the documentary had just kind of raised the topic of clearing that area out, bulldozing houses, et cetera.
Well,
I was just wondering
more on that. One of the thorniest questions of all, because Jerusalem's old city is a patchwork of Jewish and Christian and Muslim neighborhoods. And this is why people who've been trying to solve the Israeli-Arab dispute for the last, 60 years, going back to the 40s, it all comes down to maps and what kind of line you draw, especially in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is such a patchwork. And the problem before the 1967 war was that Jews had no access to their own holy sites in Jerusalem's old city. And when they got there, when Israeli soldiers arrived there in June 1967, they were shocked to see that the Jordanians had destroyed a lot of the Jewish artifacts in the area. And to their credit, the Israelis have permitted Christians and Muslims to pray at their holy sites in Jerusalem since 1967. I think, by and large, the Jews have been good religious custodians of the old city.
And thanks very much for the call. Richard is next. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. I think the whole business of the Six-Day War and its glorious, so-called glorious achievement by the Israeli army is really highly over-exaggerated. The Arabs were not that well organized and hardly hit, whereas Israel was motivated by its land grab, which it's persisted in. Its occupation of Palestinian territory has been declared illegal by the UN, which, unfortunately, is as far as they ever got with it. I think the U.S. support for Israel is a disgrace for the American government and the American people.
Jonathan.
The term land grab is thrown around. What Israel wanted in 1967 wasn't so much land, although they did end up with a lot of land. What they really wanted was to smash the militaries of Egypt and then Syria. And they did that. The land, to a certain extent, was an afterthought. And in the case of Sinai, if you call it a land grab, then you would also have to explain why Israel gave back the Sinai it was in the 1970s, and why it evacuated Gaza, and why it has been willing to talk to Syria about getting out of Golan. And why eventually it will get out of most of the West Bank. To call it a land grab, I think, is simplistic.
Thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Jonathan Kay. Jonathan is managing editor for Comment of the National Post newspaper, published in Toronto, Canada. He wrote a piece yesterday, Tuesday, June 5, 6 days that changed the Arab world forever. And we're welcoming your phone calls on the Six-Day War and what that war meant for what's going on now. 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll hear two points of view on CAFE standards and whether or not there should be a mandatory increase in CAFE standards. It's being debated before Congress right now, and we'll have people with different points of view on this after the news at 10 o'clock. Jonathan Kay is here now, managing editor for Comment of the National Post newspaper. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Daniel from Rice Lake is next. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. In a book entitled Fox Facts Over Dimona by two Israeli authors, they assert two MiGs flew over the nuclear facilities at Dimona just prior to the Six-Day War. Russia wanted its Arab allies to destroy Israel before it had nuclear weapons. The jets were not intercepted. MiG-21s piloted by Egyptians were comparable to Israeli Mirages. The authors assert the MiGs were not intercepted because they were the latest MiG-25s piloted at the time by only Russians. The overflight of the nuclear reactor at Dimona freaked out the Israeli high command and as a consequence, they ordered a preemptive air attack to destroy Egypt's air force.
Jonathan.
Yeah, this book has been getting a lot of attention, I haven't read the book, but I have read several columns about it. It is known that during the war that there were planes that overflew Dimona, although in Michael Oren's 2002 book, he says those were Arab planes. I don't know much about the larger thesis. The larger thesis of that book is that the Soviet Union deliberately provoked the war because they were looking for a pretext to destroy the Israeli nuclear facility at Dimona, and that the whole thing had been engineered by the Soviet Union. However, the war didn't go according to the Soviet plan, and the Soviets subsequently covered up their role in instigating the war. The book has been getting mixed reviews. Most historians I've seen commented on it say it's an interesting thesis, but I don't think it's going to become accepted as the mainstream thesis about how the war began. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting.
At what point, and I'm wondering who is throwing around different suggestions, you talk about the transforming Israel because of the Six-Day War from a scrappy underdog into the perception many had that it was a neo-colonial pariah and really giving fuel to a militant kind of anti-Zionism. What was being discussed in Israel as to what to do now with the West Bank and Gaza and the control of these areas? And there must have been a lot of things on the table, and there must have been a realization that the vision that many had of Israel was changing and not for the better.
I think there was a divided opinion, just as there is now. I think there were religious types who believed in greater Israel, and much of the West Bank is biblical land, and including places like Hebron.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are probably people in Israel who are very happy to have possession of that and would have been quite pleased if every Arab in the West Bank and Gaza fled. But there were others probably who realized that this was going to damage them in the international community. In the 50s and 60s in particular, Marxist ideology was so prevalent. And people forget that a lot of left-wingers very much supported Israel during that period, at least before the 1967 war, because they saw Israel as the underdog,
right,
the exploited, mm-hmm, as to a certain extent a victim of Britain and other imperial powers. And according to Marxist ideology, or at least sort of the thought that's influenced by Marxism, anyone that's oppressed or is an underdog or is exploited, there's an instinctive sympathy that the left puts on them.
Mm-hmm.
However, after 1967, that all changed. They were no longer the underdog, they were the overdog, and they were cast as a neo-colonial occupier. So in the matter of a week, everything changed, and suddenly it was the Palestinians who were the exploited. Many people didn't know the term Palestinian until after the 1967 war. They were just local Arabs. But now that you had this label to put on them, Palestinians, and they were being occupied by this other country, they immediately became very powerful beacons for left-wing sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Israel became vilified as being neo-colonialist.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Dan from De Pere. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. Shimon Peres, whom you know, I'm sure, has a quote regarding history that he is, I'm going to paraphrase, sick and tired of all history because it is one great misunderstanding and misrepresentation. And I think this is particularly true in regard to the Arab-Israeli conflict. We get all kinds of books, but they always ignore or jump over something that's important. And I think I don't know whether you jump over it or not, but I've always been very interested in the tremendous silence that engulfs the attack on the USS Liberty during that time. And I've read some different interpretations of that, but it is overwhelmingly peculiar that we ignore that. I think there was something like 30 dead, and it was a blatant attack. It was clearly identifiable, the ship. And there's some suggestion that the Israelis, or that we were trying to put some pressure on the Israelis to accept request for a truce, which I think the Arabs had conveyed on something like the fifth day, but the Israelis chose not to accept that because they wanted to push on into the Golan Heights. Now, I may well be totally misunderstanding the issue, but I do think it would be illuminating to know about what the heck happened in regard to that USS Liberty. And I wonder if you could make some comments on that.
Thanks, Dan, for the call.
Well, the Liberty incident was a particular tragedy of the Six-Day War. That was an American ship that was sunk by Israeli pilots. All sorts of conspiracy theories have been, I mean, not accusing your caller of being a conspiracy theorist, but there have been all sorts of conspiracy theories about the sinking of the Liberty. This is not something that's been hushed up. There have been books written about it. The Israelis themselves convened an investigation of it. No single theory has ever really been proven. What seems to have been the case was that the pilots in the Israeli Air Force were exhausted after 4 days of combat, and that the Navy wanted to score a victory in a battle that, to that point, had been largely confined to the ground campaign and to the Air Force. All the evidence that I've seen points to it being a tragic mistake and not part of any effort on Israel's part to silence the eyes and ears of the United States at a critical point in the war.
And thanks very much for your call. We go next to Kasser from West Bend. Hello.
Hi. I have a comment, and then I would like to make a question or a statement. I'm a Muslim born and raised in Pakistan, and I see there are two types of Muslims, Arab Muslims and non-Arab Muslims. The non-Arab Muslims consider Arab Muslims as cowards. But that is how we see, because, you know, there's a huge amount of land around Israel and almost 300 million people living around Israel, and they have not been able to achieve what they feel is right. And I happen to be part of this large majority of Muslims who believe that Israel is there to exist and we need to work with them. I want the guests to look at, for example, like 20 years ago, we had this China and we had India. They had like over 800 million people, but nobody, you know, gave them any importance because they were poor. And all of a sudden, you know, they become technologically advanced, and all of a sudden, the whole scenario changes with these two, you know, huge countries. Let's look, put that scenario in Middle East. I think the Arabs have seen the rock bottom. There are over 300 million Arabs. Eventually, they will get educated. They will get better. You know, they will get technologically advanced. They will get educated, and they will bring democracy that would help them achieve their objectives. At that time, when there are over 300 million Arabs surrounding a small country, which are and that area is equally or more advanced than the Israelis, how would Israel deal with those Arabs? And that is one thing that I think Israel should look into the future and see what will happen 20, 30 years from now when the next generation who has seen a lot of pain and suffering through the hands of Israeli aggression towards Palestinians, how would they react when they become what the Israelis are right now?
Jonathan.
It's an interesting question, but unfortunately there is no evidence that Arab societies are going to advance themselves in the way that your caller suggests. You know, going back 50, 60 years, people made similar predictions about Arab societies, even grander predictions because of the utopian pan-Arabism that I was talking about before. The problem in the Arab world is the same problem as in other parts of the world where development has stultified, including sub-Saharan Africa. You have state control of the economy. You have enormous corruption. You have nepotism at the highest levels. Economies like that don't prosper. Syria is a great example. For years, it got assistance from the Soviet Union. Its economy basically collapsed after the Soviet Union itself collapsed. It's an impoverished place. The Arab world is pretty much the only part of the globe where multi-party democracy really has not taken off, except in places where it's been actively imposed, such as Iraq, from without. And so I don't see any evidence that Arab societies are going to progress in the way that your caller indicated. A couple of years ago, there was a belief that, well, maybe we were on the cusp of that. Your listeners will remember there was the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon. Iraq looked like maybe that was going to become a beacon for the Arab world. Had democratic agitation in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt. But in all of those cases, you've seen disappointment. And certainly there seems to be something in Arab political culture that is highly inimical to the formation of democracy.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about how Egypt and Jordan were dealing with the issue of refugee camps, Palestinian refugee camps, and these impoverished Palestinian towns that you were writing about prior to 1967? What was on the table in terms of a Palestinian state, in terms of what to do to lift the lives of these people?
Oh, well, this is one of the interesting things about the era between 1948-1967. In the 2 decades between the creation of the Israeli state and the 1967 war, Egypt controlled Gaza through a military government, and Jordan controlled the West Bank. And the treatment of the Palestinians during that period was quite abysmal. One would think that Arabs governing fellow Arabs, it would be a fairly progressive, enlightened kind of governance, but it wasn't like that, and the Palestinians actually did quite badly. If you look at the socioeconomic indicators, the Palestinians actually did much better under the Israelis between 1967 and the First Intifada in the late 80s than they did under Egypt and Jordan. But no one really cared much about the plight of the Palestinians during that period, at least the ones in Gaza and West Bank, because Arabs lording over other Arabs, even in a brutal or undemocratic way, that wasn't new. But when it was Jews lording over Arabs, then suddenly it became news. And I think your caller is right in the sense that a lot of attention has been given to the Arab-Israeli conflict. In terms of sheer numbers, though, conflicts involving Muslims in places like Central and South Asia, Darfur, for instance, Muslim violence, the Iraq-Iran war, which killed about 1 million people, in sheer numbers and humanitarian effects, there have been all sorts of conflicts in the last few decades where the casualties have been hundreds of times greater than in both intifadas combined.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but the world pays a little attention because when it doesn't involve Israel, when it doesn't involve Jewish on Arab violence, for some reason the West just takes much less notice.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Mark next from Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Would this explain the reason why after the 67 war there wasn't a mass exodus of Arabs from the West Bank, similar to the kind of exodus that happened in 1947 in the area that was the original creation of Israel?
Well, there had been something of an exodus eastward toward Jordan in the years leading up to the 1967 war. Many of the Arabs that were disposed to pick up and leave had headed east into Jordan proper on the encouragement of the Jordanian government. So a lot of the people who remained were people who wanted to remain there. And I think a lot of the people were ambivalent. Palestinian society at the time and even now was a very local, village-based, tribal society. And at that time, the question of who was governing them, for many ordinary Palestinians, this is before Palestinian society became politicized in any major way, it didn't matter to that many people. I mean, don't forget, in 1948, one of the reasons many Palestinians fled was that they were advised to by the Arab leadership. Some were actively expelled by the Israelis, often in very brutal ways. But in many cases, they were acting on orders from Arab leaders. But 1967, I think it went on a village-to-village level. For a lot of people who were ordinary farmers, maybe it didn't matter to them that much that they happened to have an Israeli ruler as opposed to a Jordanian ruler. They were just looking to survive and to operate the family farm and to feed their children.
And thank you very much for the call. We're out of time for this hour. Jonathan, thank you. I would imagine that people can go to, how do people access the column? They can go to the web somehow, right, and find it?
The column appears at nationalpost.com.
Okay.
And they can just go to the opinion section, and they'll see my name, and they can click on the column.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan, so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jonathan Kay, Managing Editor for Comment of the National Post newspaper, which is published in Toronto, Canada. He's also a regular contributor to Commentary Magazine and the New York Post. Has written for Harper's, The New Yorker, The New York Times, The International Herald Tribune, The LA Times, The Weekly Standard, and many other publications. His article that we were talking about appeared yesterday in The Post. And it is titled, 6 Days That Changed the Arab World Forever. And I think it's amazing all that it's not a long article, but it's amazing all that he was able to fit into that article. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Mimi Notstein for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.